Hi, I'm Moshe, and I'm autistic.
I'm Leah, and I'm boring.
Welcome to Now You Know One Autistic,
a podcast about neurodiversity in couples, marriage, meltdowns, and making it all work.
The opinions expressed in this podcast reflect the experience of one couple and one autistic.
Nothing that you hear in this podcast should be taken as a medical opinion. And unless otherwise stated, no one is an accredited specialist in any of the many fields that comprise the autism spectrum.
But as someone who is on the autism spectrum, I feel that my experiences will be very valuable to many of you. Whether you're on the spectrum, a support person like Leah, or just a curious bystander.
If you think that you or someone you care about may be autistic, consult your family doctor. Hi, Moshe.
Hi, Leah.
How are you today?
Very well. How are you?
I'm all right. So we're going to take a little bit of a break from communication. I mean, we are communicating, right? Because we're talking.
We're currently communicating.
All right. But we're going to do a different topic today, just so that everybody doesn't get tired of the same topic over and over again.
Sounds good.
It might be a little bit of a controversial topic. It might be offensive to some viewers. So just listen with caution. And if you have younger people who may not understand, possibly listen with them so that you can explain some of the more difficult concepts in this episode. So what are we discussing today, Moshe?
So today we are titling this episode, at least at this moment, as The Uncanny Valley of Autism.
Okay. Can you explain to everyone what that means?
The Uncanny Valley of Autism. Well, the Uncanny Valley refers to the theory that when somebody goes from trying to portray a human versus someone who is decidedly unhuman, there is an increase in comfort level that gradually increases from non-human to human until a point right before fully human where there's this very significant dip. And that dip is referred to in the theory as the uncanny valley.
Right. So as you can see, maybe with that brief explanation, you can understand why we would think that some people would find this controversial. We're in no way referring to people on the spectrum or people off the spectrum as non-humans. It really is just the theory and the definition. The reason why non-human is used in the definition is because it was actually coined by people who work in robotics. They were trying to make robots more people-like.
Correct.
And they noticed that as their robots became more and more human, people in general would like them very much until they became too human, but not quite. And that would cause feelings of unease, let's say.
Correct.
So the definition, I mean, that I wrote down, so let's just go with that. What is the Uncanny Valley theory in general? So it says that people find human-like robots and or animations more appealing the more human they appear until they don't. So when I say animations, they also sort of use this theory in animated movies. Animated studios use it. They use it a lot in video games. If the non-human entity, let's say, is too close, but not quite human, they tend to cause a feeling of unease and creepiness. So when I was doing my research, one really cool story that I found was it's a really popular movie, Shrek. I mean, it's a huge hit. Mm-hmm. Apparently, when they first screened it for small children, a lot of them ended up crying or panicking or wanting to leave, asking for their mom, because apparently Fiona looked too human. So they actually had to go back to the drawing board and make her look more like a cartoon. And now it's the hit that we know.
Exactly. Because I don't know, Leia can probably explain it a little bit better, but essentially, the way it works in theory is that the things that someone find comforting or, you know, positive emotion invoking about things that resemble humans end up creating a sense of unease when the subject or the object rather is human looking. But there's just something slightly, or not maybe not so slightly, off about it. Like, for example, the reason that people find zombies to be creepy is because they're basically human, but obviously there's something decidedly unhuman about them. It's the same reason that some people are afraid of dolls, or some people are afraid of clowns, or some people are afraid, I use the word afraid, but some people are creeped out, I should say, by things that are human looking, but there's just something about them that makes them feel like uncomfortable, right?
Yeah. So I looked at a lot of charts and I looked at a lot of studies, and the theory goes that people will like non-human objects that resemble humans up until a point when they switch. There's this line where they switch to, okay, well, this is, oh, look, it's a robot trying to be human. How cute is that? But there's a point where they can become so lifelike that they switch to, oh, that is a human failing at being human. That's creepy. And that is the valley that you're talking about. So if you look up a graphic about Uncanny Valley, you literally see like a dip in the graph, and that's considered the Uncanny Valley. It's that small portion of space where it goes from, wow, that's a robot trying to be cute, to, ooh, that's a human failing miserably at being.
Correct.
So how does this all tie into our topic? I think that was sort of loosely, vaguely.
Yeah, we're talking a lot about the concept of Uncanny Valley, and I'm sure you could look up podcasts that deal specifically with the Uncanny Valley in the sense of what it is and why it is and what might have caused it or what have you. But what we're actually talking about, and again, it's something of a controversial topic, which is why we waited until the third episode to bring it up, is how, and again, I'm autistic, so I'm maybe a little bit in a better position to talk about it, or at least introduce it, how autistic people or neurodivergent people can invoke in non-autistics the uncanny valley effect, and just to be fair, how non-neurodivergents can invoke the same reaction, or if they even invoke the same reaction in an autistic, and just to tie it all together, why uncanny valley, the theory of uncanny valley is or maybe, you can obviously give your own opinion, but our hypothesis is that the uncanny valley theory actually is different or even somewhat absent in an autistic. And we'll definitely talk about that as well.
Yeah. So over and over again, you'll hear especially autistic males, for some reason, be described as creepy.
Mm-hmm.
So people will do, you know, they'll have what's called a thin slice judgment or a snap judgment, where they will look at a person, take in the visual and very base information, and just go, ooh, he's creepy. Now, why do you think, or what do you think the reason behind that is?
Well, as someone who is on the spectrum, as the intro has mentioned, pardon me, is that the theory is that an autistic person, particularly an autistic person that is masking, is acting a certain way, but the mask is not perfect because it's not able to be, because it's, you know, a person is either autistic or they're not. And we're not even going to get into the theory that there's autistics out there who are just so good at masking and are able to maintain it consistently that they're essentially not autistic at all.
Yes, but you don't have to be like me or a trained professional to see it. For often trained professionals miss it, because you would be surprised how many times I get asked, you know, Moshe, he's such a great guy, but is there something wrong with him? And it'll take people like 3 months of really close contact with you to even go there.
And that's exactly it. And this is why it's coming up. It would be a very different podcast episode if it were two neurotypicals sitting together and going, don't you think autistic people are creepy? But this is actually not only a theory that we researched and read about and found examples of. This is my lived experience. This is my lived experience from the time I was very young until the present, even, where people have met me at various stages in my life, in various stages of my autism. And I should really say in various stages of my masking my autism. And they would be close to me and they would, you know, sometimes they would go, oh, I don't know. There's something going on there. Or I would enter a new work environment and I would get called in to human resources offices because people would say, you know, I don't actually know what this is about, but some people have been mentioning that you've made them feel very uncomfortable. Do you know what that might be caused by? And of course, I was surprised because I had no idea, number one, that I was, and number two, why I would. And number three, I couldn't even imagine what it was about what I was doing that made them feel uncomfortable.
It's unfortunate that the answer to it is you weren't actually doing anything. They were basically seeing your micro expressions and the way that you look like them, but you're not acting quite like them. And they had a snap response.
Yes. And some people were very subtle about it, and they just avoided me entirely. And some people were very non-subtle about it. In a previous job that I had, we were sitting at a bunch of cubicles, and I was sitting across the cubicle, separated by like a glass or a poly something. You know, what's the word I'm looking for? Pane, we'll say. Like a pane of transparent, clear substance. Mm-hmm. Probably glass, maybe not. Doesn't matter for the points of this. And there was this other female coworker that sat on the other side of it. And I would take calls, as I always do. And I would just sit there and I would be emoting and carrying on. And eventually I noticed that she would tape pieces of paper over the glass facing me. And I was who I am. And I was like, I'm sorry, why are you doing that? And she would say, I don't know that you know, but when you're on the phone or when you're working, sometimes you kind of look over at me and you have this look on your face and it makes me very uncomfortable. So I cannot concentrate on what I'm doing and look at you. And I'm sorry. I don't know if it's intentional. I don't know if this is something that you know that you're doing, but I need to not look at you while I'm working.
Right. So that is actually very interesting because that face thing that you're describing is essentially unmasking. So it's when you're distracted by something else or tired or upset and you forget to put tension in your eyebrows and trap the corners of your mouth and, you know, do human check, like, is my face doing all the things? And that happens a lot. And it unfairly, maybe, or maybe not, creeps some people out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's kind of something that I've had to live with. But even before I had my diagnosis, I maybe unconsciously came up with ways around it. And the way that I chose, the way that was most convenient for me, is I made myself harmless, or as harmless as I possibly could. So I would walk around with my eyes down. I would sort of curl up in like a very shoulders inverted, like very, very, very non-threatening position. Because what I thought, and I don't even know to this day if it was a valid assumption or not, was I thought people were actually afraid of me.
Right.
So I looked, I said, okay, well, if they're afraid of me, then I have to make myself as non-threatening as possible. And so eventually I got the nickname of Sully from Monsters, Inc., where they said, you're a monster, but you're a very cuddly, warm, approachable monster.
Again, if you see him, he does kind of look like Sully. He's a tall guy, you know, big arms, big shoulders, big beard. I see why people went there.
Yes. So I was an approachable person, and I made myself very, very non-threatening. But interestingly enough, this worked quite well on I didn't do like a poll of the office, but it worked very well on a lot of the people that I worked with. But I noticed that there were a lot of employees there that were actually very different, and they never had a problem with me. They were very, they approached me, they talked to me, they found me to be very
right,
nice and sweet and friendly. And I one of them happened to have been my supervisor, and I brought up to her one day about the fact that this was happening. And she says, I have no idea what's going on. Like, I've never noticed anything. Like, I don't, like, I sit like pretty close to you, and I haven't noticed that you have a look on your face, or that there's anything that would cause them to do that. Maybe they're moving to a different department anyway. So you should probably not even worry about it. But if it's up to me, I'm telling you, there's nothing that you're doing that seems to be, you know, causing that kind of reaction.
That must have been so unhappy and so uncomfortable for you. And another pitfall, people not having a diagnosis until they're much, much older.
Right.
I can't put my toe or our toe into a topic that we sort of kissed and we're going to have to reveal eventually, is we, unfortunately for us, haven't always been together. We haven't always been a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And that coping mechanism that Moshe describes led me to find a much different man than I had left many years before. And actually, this thing that he said works for everybody else absolutely did not work for me. Because he used to be, you know, tall and big and brazen and arrogant. And maybe a lot of people didn't like that, but I did. And I said, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk about the world affecting somebody, if you want to talk about the world beating somebody down, especially for something that's not even their fault, it was a very, very sad, unfortunate thing.
Yeah. And the problem that many autistics face, and again, I'm just one autistic, so I can't really comment on the autistic community at large. But the problem that I would venture that a lot of autistics and the ones that I've met have faced is the different masks that they end up having to wear. And they wear a mask for work, and they wear a mask for their friends, and they wear a mask if they have a relationship for their partner. And they wear a mask that they just kind of put on when they go out, because they're going to be around people. And they're like, well, I have to go to the store and be out in public, and it's going to be bright, and it's going to be loud, and it's going to be a lot of different sensations. And if I want to fit in, then I have to wear a mask. And if you're the kind of person that I was, undiagnosed, didn't even know that I was autistic, just knew that people were creeped out by me, then it was an unconscious effort. It's not like someone told me, okay, you have to look a certain way and act a certain way when you're in public. Autistics often do it without even intending to do it. And they it's called masking. It's a concept that is very familiar to the neurodivergent community, but essentially, in very quick summary, it's the ability to put on a certain appearance or demeanor or mannerism.
To mimic and copy people that they find neurotypical so that they can be more like them,
right,
and be accepted socially.
And actually, it's something that a lot of the, we'll call them theories of quote-unquote handling an autistic, is to teach them to mask.
Because ABA is all teachings and theory.
Right. And the thing that sort of ties into the beginning of this episode is that Leia, and in particular myself, are not saying that autistics are creepy. And we're not talking about how people with autism create this feeling that other people are creeped out by them. What we're saying is that in an effort to attempt to mask and behave the way we are taught or told or led to believe that we're supposed to act, we end up wearing someone else's face.
And you essentially fall into that valley.
We put ourselves in it.
To no fault of your own, and other people are not understanding. So let's talk about actually an interesting concept. This seems to be the more functional you are,
mm-hmm,
the lower support needs you have. I'm doing air quotes, by the way, if you can't hear it in that voice. The more the uncanny valley seems to become a problem, because the more capable of masking you. So that was also within our research. And the next step to that is it's even harder for women on the spectrum. and it is the hardest for attractive women on the spectrum.
Based on the studies.
Yeah. Why do you think that might be?
Well, it really does kind of go back to a number of things that I just said, which is when you are raised the way that I am and the way I'm sure a lot of other autistics are raised, and I just want to make mention of the fact that there's a lot of parents out there who were unfamiliar with autism up until the moment that their child was diagnosed. And they often have the very best of intentions and think that they're doing the best that they can to help their child. And why would you ever have this person that you absolutely adore and love and cherish and want the best for, and not try to do what you feel is what they need in order to function? Because nobody wants to, you know, slap a label on their child's forehead and say, well, this kid is non-functional, or this kid is semi-functional, this kid is differently abled, or whatever, you know, buzzword you want to use. And subsequently, you're basically teaching your child to, in effect, go out in public wearing a clown mask, because they're told that they need to wear this clown mask. And I use clown mask because I know that it's creeped out by clowns. But they're basically telling their kid, you can't go out with that face. You have to wear this clown mask so people will recognize that you are a part of them. And people will look at them and go, you know, who the heck is this? And then the kid will be like, I don't understand why people are all creeped out by me. I'm putting on the mask that you wanted me to wear. But conversely, if you have a parent who either is so unfamiliar with autism that they're like, I don't know, just do whatever, or they are familiar enough with it that they're like, you know what? No, my kid is autistic. He stims. He has different mannerisms. He has a weird walk. He has a weird way of doing things. He's always moving and twiddling his fingers and twirling his hair and blinking and snorting and doing all manner of things. And if you don't like it, well, too bad, because that's who he is.
That's the kind of parent I am.
Yes. Those are the kids that are actually, that don't get that reaction. Because if you're out in public, then people are seeing you, and sometimes you're just acting a certain way, or sometimes you're overly sound sensitive, so you have your muffs on, or sometimes you're overly visually sensitive, and then you have dark glasses on, or sometimes you have a parent who's walking around with their child on a harness.
Got it.
And there's different terms that people use, which I am still like, imagine later in life learning in my 40s that I'm autistic, and now learning the way autistic, you know, parents or people are supposed to be. It's like reading an instruction manual about yourself and going, oh, that's how I'm supposed to act. But if you're out in public, if you're at the coffee shop, or you're out for a walk, or you're at the park, and you're a kid, you have an 8-year-old, and you have 2 8-year-olds. Let's say you're a parent, your friend is also a parent, and both of you have an 8-year-old boy, and both boys are at the park playing. And one boy is just living his life, doing his best, and, you know, occasionally he'll like do stuff and then just act a certain way. And then the other boy will go, I don't want to be his friend, he's weird. But then you have this other boy who's like wearing earmuffs, and he's like shaking his hands and stuff and really excited. And it's like, oh my gosh, he's so cute.
Exactly. So
doesn't that seem contradictory to you?
It does, but it's a true thing. I'll tell you exactly why. Avram, by neurotypical standards, Avram is so weird. Let's be honest. He's a weird little dude.
He is.
But he's so popular. People love him. He's only ever described as adorable, cute, smushy, so smart, so talented. Let's be his friend. So cool. Because he's not expected to not be who he is.
Right. And that is exactly the problem. And this is the second soapbox of the series, that it only took, you know, 3 episodes. I have a real problem. And again, this is not just my own opinion. This is based on my lived experience. I have a real problem, and I struggled. And I'll be the first one to say that I struggled with it. Because you'd think that if you're autistic, suddenly you understand all autistics, but you don't. You don't understand it. Like, we're one autistic, and if you know one autistic, you know one autistic. That's the name of the podcast. Now you know one autistic. Thank you for listening. But I struggled with it, and I came to a conclusion, unfortunately, later than I should have, which is, I am very uncomfortable with anything that tries to teach someone with autism to stop acting like they have autism.
Right. Because they do. So why should?
Because why would you tell anyone, especially a child, that they have to act in a way that's not who they actually are?
I do want to put a disclaimer here. Some children actually do need therapy in order to be able to engage with the world at all.
Right.
So some of them are very enclosed in their, you want to use another term, own world. Some of them don't have speech. And if they want to engage with the world, they do need therapy. And a lot of them are very grateful that they've had that therapy and can engage now.
Right. And I'll add to that, that when I talk about you know, raising your child like they're not autistic, I'm not talking about dealing with like profound issues that will actually limit their ability to function at all. I'm talking about, and here's another soapbox topic, the high functioning autistic, which, you know, stims a little bit, and we're trying to get him to stop doing that, and he's really hung up on one thing, and you got to get him to learn how to do this. It's the things that allow them to mask better. But then you have autistics, and because autism is a global delay, you have autistics that are, I'm not going to use the word, but are definitely communicative. And a lot of these parents are referred to speech therapists, which isn't a bad thing, because if a child is having difficulty learning how to form words, then there are therapies that you can use to sort of take them through the steps and maybe help them to communicate. And then there's different things that they can do to allow them to function.
So we lived in Canada, and the healthcare system in Canada stinks.
It is.
And Akram has what you would call an affectation in his mouth that causes him to have an accent. So I'm going to say, or lisp.
It's not really an accent, it's an affectation.
And he did not get speech therapy in time, so he still has that and he'll likely have it forever.
But it's not nearly as bad as it used to be.
No. He sounds, how would you put it? He kind of sounds like a British baby or like a Bostonian or something. You'll hear him eventually.
When I first met him, it was very interesting. And as his voice has changed, it's actually gotten a lot less significant, but it's there, and it's just how he talks. And in an effort to try and correct him, they wanted to make his affectation stop. And I guess for their efforts, they really thought that was something that was important for him. But I don't really understand why.
It's not to his overall functionality. The only thing I could say is that he's a bit sensitive about it. So if you bring it up, he will say, stop making fun of my accent because I can't help it. There was a point in time where he became aware of it, probably around 7-ish years old. And he knows it's a thing, but it's just the way his mouth works. And in an attempt for them to correct his speech, he sort of started to sound a bit like robotic. And I think I would just rather him sound like himself. What do you think?
I think it's important for him to be himself. And because we are living in Israel, and the expectation is that children speak Hebrew, which has a whole series of other affectations that are associated with that language. And we discovered that when he speaks Hebrew, he doesn't have an affectation. It's kind of interesting because for whatever reason, we know some people from different parts of the world who do have accents or affectations, that when they speak Hebrew, they still maintain it, which is interesting to me. I am fortunate in that I have lived in multiple regions, in multiple countries now, and I have adapted my vocalization to a variety of different things. My grandmother, my bubby, spent several years in England, so she adopted a somewhat British affectation. Not an accent so much, just, you know, vestibule and strawberries and stuff. So I admired her, so I took that on. And I lived in Quebec, so I had something of a Quebecois accent for a while. And then I lived in Western Canada for many years, so I had something of a West Coast Californian thing. And I lived in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick for a while. So I sort of took on a little bit of the Atlantic Canadian, you know, brum, rum, roof, you know, things like that. So I would say that at this point, my different ways of pronouncing things continue to amuse. And the other thing is, unfortunately, I have also been told that I have a bad voice. And so I have been corrected in my pronunciation of things at various points in my childhood. So I tend to speak a lot slower than I might have done at one point because...
It makes you amazing at customer service.
Because I do things fast. I walk fast, I eat fast, I drink fast, I run. I'm always moving fast. So what I've been told, and this actually came from my father, is slow down and soften your tone. Because I had volume control issues. And a lot of autistics do, to my understanding, where I would basically speak everything at a very high volume because I was expressing myself. I was passionate about it. And if you're passionate about something, what you really want to do is yell in somebody's face as loud as you can so they can hear the excitement in your voice.
You want to talk about another misunderstanding. Try to explain that to somebody. Ma'am, why is your large husband yelling in your face?
So
he's not.
It took me years
along
for people to be like, calm down. And so now I feel like, I don't know, you can tell me. And there's going to be editing software because it's very quiet and I'm a lot louder. But my voice has sort of become a lot more even toned, I guess.
Yeah, I think you have an amazing voice, actually.
Thank you.
So going back to the topic then, having said all that and all the difficulties that it causes, you know, the neurotypical parties and their discomforting feelings and the autistic parties in not understanding why people around them don't like them or don't want to be around them, et cetera. Do you think that unmasking could help? So I'm going to call back to the example you gave. The woman that you worked with, if she had said, I'm not sure why you creep me out, but you creep me out, and you could have said, I apologize, but it's because I'm autistic and I can't always mask what my face is doing. Do you think that would have helped the situation?
Probably not, but she was Russian. And so much like many Israelis here, Eastern Europeans, Russians, Israelis, a lot of different demographic groups tend to be much more, a lot of Asian, you know, groups, they tend to be much more blunt in their speech. Americanized and Canadianized social skills are very reserved, very shy, very constructed, very sanitized.
Yes, in Jerusalem, we've already heard the R word multiple times. They still use it here.
And it's my word.
They don't need offense.
No, but I mean, this is exactly the point. And I said it in the first episode, and I'll say it again. Because when I was growing up, back in way, way back in the 1980s and 90s, we didn't really have a very good understanding of neurodivergency. We certainly might not have called it neurodivergency. So when people asked me what was wrong with me, they would assume that I was retarded. Because that doesn't necessarily, now, it's actually a very pejorative term for mentally challenged or mentally, you know,
delayed.
Intellectual delay is, I guess, the term now. But retarded was sort of the catch-all term for anyone who expresses or projects themselves in a different way.
If you look it up, it literally
means slow.
Slow or delayed.
Yeah.
It's gotten a really, really bad rap because of the way it's been used as an abusive word.
And it is. And there's very few instances where, unless you're referring to someone in French being late, that you can use the word retard or retarded in a positive way.
I can never.
But it's my word, and I'm going to use it. And if you have an issue with me using it, then absolutely let me know. But again, as I said in the very first episode, way two episodes ago, it's a word that I've had to adapt for myself because one of the common catchphrases that I came up with for telling people what I was, because they were like, "Are you retarded?" And I started telling people, no, I'm not retarded. I'm autistic. And they were like, ooh, you can't use that word. So now I'm going to put it on a t-shirt. And I don't know that anyone would ever actually print it, but it's very important. And I taught it to Avram.
Back in Canada, he also used to say, I'm autistic. I'm not the R word. But then for us to come here and be in his meeting for school and for them to ask us questions. And one of the questions was, he's not R, is he? And I went, what planet are we on?
Because it's a different way of life. Anyway, that is to say that if you are autistic, then you can, I would be able to say at this point, given my recent experience and not so recent experience, that if I had to pick between teaching your child how to function like a human, and again, don't mean that autistic people aren't humans, but try to function in a way that doesn't project your disability or your different ability, I don't know what even want to call it, to the forefront, or to teach them to just accept and love and operate. Because again, I just want to say for the record that I am not saying, and Leia is not saying, that if your child or your partner or your friend or your spouse or whatever is autistic, that every one of their behaviors just kind of has to be accepted as part of who they are.
Absolutely
not. Because you can still say you are autistic, and I understand that this behavior is because you're autistic, but it's still not a behavior that I, you know, that I feel is fair or good or functional. And so we need to work on that.
I actually think I'm going to compile a list of things, and one episode will actually be a game that I like to play called, you know, is Moshe being autistic or is he just being a man?
Because what Leia and I like to say is autism is not an obstacle. It is not a barrier. Sorry, it's a barrier. It's not a barrier. It's an obstacle. It's something that you have to overcome. But it doesn't mean that someone just is that way. They're just naturally arrogant, naturally selfish, naturally don't care about other people, naturally have no empathy, naturally treat others with disrespect, naturally, you know, operate in a way that is just who they are. That's just what happens.
There are certain things that are autism and certain things that are personality. And separating the two is sometimes difficult. But what I've always said to Moshe is, it is harder for you, but it is not impossible.
Exactly.
This topic is very important to me. So we're going to talk about it again, and we're going to work on it.
And this has been the long-term work that Leia and I put into our relationship. And again, to be fair, it's as much about how I relate to her as it is about how she relates to me. And that's a whole other different topic. But back to the original question, some people will look at somebody who is very clearly autistic, or they'll ask them, but why are you behaving that way? And then you'll go, I'm autistic. And they'll be like, oh, okay, that makes sense now. I'm sorry, I was wondering. Or they'll go, you know what, I don't care. I still don't like that behavior. And that's just something you kind of have to learn to deal with.
So that is your experience and your opinion. Doing my research again on the internet, the majority of people do think that unmasking and autism will help a lot with this phenomenon.
Universally, absolutely.
Because a lot of people, they really are nice and they will understand. It's just that they don't know.
Correct.
They don't have a file in their brain that tells them what to do when somebody's facial muscles all go slack and they're, you know.
Right.
So it's a learning opportunity for them as well.
Right.
So this would be a really good time for us to turn the table, actually, and say, Moshe, do I creep you out? Do autistics actually experience the uncanny valley?
And the answer is we do, somewhat, and not in the same way. And again, I just want to preface this, as I always do, with saying that this is the experience of one autistic, and it may not reflect on everyone else. But autistic people have been observed in various studies where their discomfort may even be the reverse of uncanny valley, where they'll find it more comfortable for people that are less human looking than more human looking. I think they refer to it as like the uncanny cliff or the uncanny hill.
It's a drop off. Yeah, absolutely.
And that is the one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that autistic people will not traditionally be creeped out in the same way as neurotypicals, again, just experience based on research and my own experience, because we don't have, or at least we're not born with the innate concept that certain things should make us uncomfortable. So if a situation is scary, or a person is meant to be creepy, or there's a zombie or a monster on the screen, mm-hmm. If you have an autistic child, the autistic child will offer very little reaction, or they might actually laugh at it because they're so silly looking. Mm-hmm. But they won't have the innate concept that this kind of person is looking that way in order to be creepy.
Right. And we actually talked about this afternoon. We came up with this theory on our own.
Right.
Is that autistic people in general seem to have less of a concern about their own safety.
Correct.
That's not every autistic, obviously. Avram has that issue. So he, where danger is really a concept. Preservation of one's life is not something that you wish your processing power on. So it may actually prevent the uncanny valley because neurotypicals like me and many of you out there are sort of born with the genes of our ancestors, where if we were sitting by the campfire and we saw creepy eyes in the woods, that was actual danger to our lives. So that could be where this reaction comes from, whereas autistics seem to sort of be missing that.
Yes, a lot of autistic people, particularly autistic parents of autistic people, have noted that their child seemed to lack a fear response. It had to be explained to them. And trying to explain to someone why they should be afraid of certain things seems almost counterproductive. It's like inserting negativity into a person's positive outlook. And I found it very fascinating, actually, because autism is a very difficult concept to nail down. And again, if you've ever tried to look up the question, what is autism, you get millions and millions of different studies and hits and references, and it could be this, or it could be that, or it could be this, or it could be that. So it's really not something that people have spent a lot of time studying. So I do what I always do. And I said, okay, well, what's something that's like autism that might be better at defining it? So I did a lot of research on something called Williams syndrome. And you can actually look that up. It's a genetic, we'll call it disorder. And a lot of the symptoms of Williams syndrome are very similar or even identical to autism. And in fact, in a bit of a double whammy, a lot of people with Williams syndrome are also diagnosed with autism. So I'm not even sure how that goes, but it is out there. And the characteristics
is that the DSM-6 is going to look very different. Exactly. Stay tuned, folks.
Because people have the piecemeal disorders. And they interviewed people with Williams syndrome. And Williams syndrome children and adults, because it's fortunately not one of those disabilities that actually reduces your lifespan or causes any serious health issues, I don't believe. And again, if I'm wrong, please let me know. But it also comes with a complete absence of fear, a complete absence of suspicion, and a complete absence of wariness, and a complete absence of the ability to see someone or something as a threat. And there have been instances where children with Williams syndrome, much like autistic children, will just run into traffic, not because they're concerned. Even if they see the car coming, they'll be like, oh, I want to go there. It's right across the street.
That's why I had Avram on a leash. And if you have a problem with that, you can certainly write to me.
And this is the idea. And they talk to people with Williams syndrome because their speech is oftentimes very articulate. They're very, very articulate. And a lot of them, they're still not sure why, but a lot of them have enhanced auditory sensations. So they're very musically inclined, a lot of them. And they talked to them and they said, why don't you feel like, why are you concerned? Like, why aren't you concerned that these things might hurt you? And it's a complete absence of the ability to conceive a lot of times that a person would be harmful. So they'll go up to complete strangers and hug them and tell them their whole life story. Because they lack the ability to understand that this person who they don't know from nobody might be a threat to them.
Right.
And it's kind of sad because you have to tell this child, this adult even, who is basically kept in a state of innocence, that they have to be afraid when they have no concept of what fear even is. But fear is actually a very positive thing. We have these instincts in our subconscious to help us, to protect us. If we see a fire, we don't go walking into the fire because we know it's going to burn us. If we see a man standing there holding a giant machete, we go, you know what? I think that guy with the hockey mask and the machete might intend to harm me. Whereas person with autism or Williams syndrome might be like, wow, that guy is kind of cool. I wonder what he's up to.
What are you doing? Yeah, exactly. And
because they don't have the ability to understand that person might be a threat to them.
Exactly. And this brought up a whole other thing, because you know that I'm a giant nerd and we might explore this more in another episode.
Right.
But in terms of why, if you subscribe to Darwinism, why nature hasn't actually selected against autism at this point?
Yeah. So Darwinism is a really good theory. And of course, we are Orthodox Jews. So it's very much part and parcel of what we believe anyway, because Judaism definitely does accept science. So the idea of evolution and an evolved evolution based on the strongest characteristics of each individual person or thing or animal or what have you is there.
Our whole book is about that.
And the reality, exactly. And the reality of the situation.
We were better than them. We smashed. That's the whole 5 books.
Is that Darwinism is not bad. And again, I don't want the soundbite from this episode to be Moshe and Leia talk about the fallacy of Darwinism. No, that's not what we're saying. Darwinism is actually a very valid concept. But what we're saying is that maybe the fittest amongst us is not necessarily the goal. Maybe.
Right. So that's a very confusing thing to me, because you would think theoretically that a person who has no care for their safety and a very limited ability to care for themselves would have been selected against back in the days of cavemen.
Right.
And I have some interesting ideas as to why that hasn't happened. But you know what? That might actually be a good topic for premium content.
It would be. We can discuss the nature of Darwinism as it relates to neurodivergency and why Darwinism does not disqualify neurodivergency and some theories behind that. But essentially, when you have a community, if you're individuals, then obviously the person who can run the fastest and live the longest and put up with the most harsh conditions are going to be in demand. But when you settle down and start building communities and you have a multitude of different people who are all differently able, then you can look at your population and go, you know what? We have X number of people over there doing all the heavy lifting. These people seem to struggle with social concepts, but they're real good at figuring out things. Maybe we should put them to work on that. And you guys with the clubs and the spears, you can keep them safe so that they can do their job. And in turn, they will design better spears for you or something like that.
That's essentially, yes, what happened or what I think happened. And so I don't know what this episode has become. It's definitely hasn't stuck to the topic. I do have a couple of more things that I wanted to cover. Do autistics and non-autistics fall into each other's uncanny valley? Now, I have something personally to say about this. Moshe, in any of his incarnations as a child, as a teenager, as an adult, has never creeped me out, ever. However, clowns make me cringe. I will run away. I will smack them. So try to explain that to me.
I can't explain that to you. It's just phobias is outside of my price, you know, is outside of my pay range.
But the phobia of clowns it's known as coulrophobia. It's a very popular phobia.
Yes.
And I believe it's actually based in the uncanny valley characteristic.
It actually is. And it's a very common phobia. And it does actually fall, at least I believe that it does, in the same category of why people are creeped out in certain respects by autistics who are masking, because they're acting in a way that's human, but also not quite human.
People find this very funny. I'm warning you now. Don't email me pictures of clowns. Don't send me clowns. Don't.
But the uncanny valley effect for autistics is a difficult concept to express, because when you're autistic and you're finding it difficult to social with someone, it actually makes you more comforted by somebody who is less traditionally focused or looking, rather, but they don't fit the model of what you have come to feel is threatening to you. So, for example, somebody who, I don't know, I want to use a really extreme example.
Great, something new and different for you.
Yes. So let's say I was talking to somebody who had their eyes gouged out.
I get bald.
I wouldn't find that very creepy.
I would.
Because to me, the eyes are one of the things that autistic people often struggle to relate to. And in fact, I'll tell a really quick story because we're running low on time. I again, called into the human resources office because one of the supervisors at one of my employers said that I was leering at her. And I was called into the office and the human resources manager talked to me and said, okay, so the complaint is that he is looking at me and then he'll look away and then he'll look at me and then he'll look away and then he'll look at me. And based on that, I was apparently scanning her body up and down. So he talked to me and he asked me what happened and what I think was happening. And he looked at me and he saw that my eyes would look at him and then look away and then look at him and then look away. And he said, you know what? I already know what's happened here. You can go. There's nothing. I'm going to dismiss this. And I didn't know why at the time. I thought, oh, cool. So I'm free to go then. Great. And he said, you know, just maybe stay away from her if that's how she feels.
Some people are so full of themselves.
And that is essentially what it really came down to. But if somebody had a difficulty, if someone's blind, I find it a lot easier to look at them than if someone is we'll say a regular psycho.
When we're talking about communication again in the next episode, we're going to delve deeply into eye contact action.
And a lot of the things that make it hard for me to look at people or relate to people are what anyone would consider to be normal. But then to top it off and sort of one of our final statements, what I find creepy is anything that goes away from the concept of what I determine is a standard function of the human body. So tattoos creep me out. Piercings creep me out. Plastic surgery creeps me out. Because in my mind, I have learned, either consciously or unconsciously, the way a person is supposed to look. And anything that goes outside of that norm, makeup, believe it or not.
Yeah, don't wear makeup.
Makes me uncomfortable. Because anything that alters a person's appearance beyond what my concept of their appearance should be. And again, that can come across as very controlling. And it's been pointed out to me.
I would like to say I don't wear makeup anymore. And that was my choice because it made him uncomfortable. He didn't demand that.
But it's very simple for that to go, well, you know, he's trying to control me. He doesn't want me to wear makeup. Actually, it's a lot sadder than that. It's that I have struggled to relate to people, as many autistics have. And my way of relating to them is to essentially picture them in a certain way. And if they don't exactly match that concept of how they're supposed to look, then I find that makes me very uncomfortable. But it has to be subtle. And that's the difference. It has to be subtle. It has to be, I have a tattoo, or I have a particular, I had hair growing out of my nose.
The hair and the nose guy, but we were both uncanny valley by him.
Right.
We discussed that. So there was a man, he was a very nice man. He was checking one of our groceries for us. And he had hair growing all the way down the bridge of his nose to the tip. And Moshe and I both noticed it, but I was able to sort of talk myself down from it where he was totally creeped up by it. He didn't say anything. We should congratulate him. He was very good about it. But I was sort of able to be like, okay, so this is weird. But I'm sure this man is very nice and continue to just treat him the way that I would anybody. And that feeling of initial unrest for me went away. Moshe claims that it didn't, but he was very good about it. He wasn't insulted.
Oh, no, because I have learned over time that I have no poker face. So if I'm finding someone to be particularly, if I find something about someone that makes me particularly uncomfortable, a lot of the time I'll just look away or I won't engage with them. And it can come across as shy or unfriendly or why isn't he looking at me? But really, it's as much for you as it is for me because I don't want to look at you and have a reaction. Yes. And I make you uncomfortable.
We discussed this earlier, actually. I can tell by the way he's holding his shoulders, the cut of his jaw, the look in his eye, the look on his face, what he's likely to be feeling. And when people in meetings, for example, look at him and say, Moshe, do you have anything to add? I will openly say at this point, nothing that you want to hear.
And that is actually something that we can talk about in the next episode on revisiting communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you have any final points?
I mean, for me, I actually left space for conclusions, but I wanted to share one thing that another content creator said.
Sure.
An autistic content creator. She is a high functioning female autistic who was also diagnosed later in life.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you know, the reason why neurotypical people are often uncomfortable in dealing with autistic people is because autistic people who are unmasked will violate the human norms of social interactions. Sometimes what it can do is hold up a mirror to us,
mm-hmm,
regarding really how insignificant and how shallow a lot of the things neurotypicals concentrate on are.
Right. And that is something that sort of intersects between sort of the uncanny valley concept that we were talking about today and revisiting communication, because something that autistics are very good at is brutal honesty, unfiltered by social norms, social cues, social, you know, customs. And this is what led me to make a teacher at Avram School cry. And the fact that when we were at
don't be modest, more than once.
And when we were at another meeting, most recently, I made another teacher cry, because I have learned through experience that I am not very good at either hiding my expression or hiding my feelings. So the question becomes, if you want my opinion, I will give you my opinion, but you might not want my opinion if you want to lull yourself into a sense of, you know, self-righteousness or sense of security about what you're doing, because I will tell you to your face, what you're doing is unfair, unjust. You're clearly unaware of what you're doing. And I will just kind of sit back and go, well, you wanted my opinion.
Yeah. And that's fair. I mean, you go into meetings for Avram with only Avram in mind, and sure, you're not shy about that.
Yeah.
You don't really care how the teacher is.
Yes. Because I'm out for my family, I'm out for my kids, I'm out for Leia, and I am never shy to talk about how something makes me feel. I've been told that I should be, but I don't think that that's reasonable.
Absolutely. So, do we have any conclusions about the uncanny valley and autism?
The only conclusion that I have is essentially we've already discussed, which is that the uncanny valley, once again, is not saying that autistic people are by their nature creepy. It's that, unfortunately, we live in a society, wherever you happen to live when you're listening to this, that tells you that you have to behave in a certain way. And because autistics don't necessarily always behave in the way that they're expected to behave, that they're told that they have to behave a certain way, and by trying to be someone that they're not, then they end up causing more people to be uncomfortable by them than if they just were like, you know what, this is who I am, and that is something that you'll have to get used to. So if you're autistic and you've had experiences like I have, let me know, write in, comment on this, rate us 5 stars or 4 stars or 1 star, whatever. But don't be ashamed and don't be uncomfortable by your own autism. Accept it, love it. If you have an autistic child, don't try and figure out ways to make them, you know, look more normal. Accept who they are and help other people.
You want to say it also on the other way around. If one of your friends or a spouse of yours or somebody you're dating gives you that creepy feeling, don't be ashamed of that. Openly communicate it. So your face is doing a thing. Is there something you'd like to tell me?
And that's definitely a good way to open up a conversation. And maybe start a dialogue about breaking down barriers and understanding each other better.
Can we end on a joke?
Sure.
Moshe?
Yes.
What do you call it when you mask so well that a neurotypical can't tell that you're autistic?
I don't know. What do you call it?
You committed espionage.
Thank you for listening. Well, that's our show for today. Now you know one autistic just a little bit better. So something you may not know about some autistics is that we often struggle with ending social interactions. So, Leah?
All right, Monsha, I'll take care of it. Thank you for listening to Now You Know One Autistic. See you next week.